This is the Past Lives podcast, and I'm your host, Simon Bown. My mission here at the Past Lives podcast is to investigate evidence that demonstrates survival of the human soul. We look at past life memories, near-death experiences, spirit communication, and other incredible phenomena. To get access to the extended versions of the episodes, you can join the Past Lives podcast Patreon campaign. And when you sign up for $5 a month, you get an extended episode every week. And for $2 a month, you get an extended episode every month. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/pastlivespodcast or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastlifeshypnosis.co.uk. Also, when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me and you're a patron, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. The links are in the show notes, and you can find the show notes for this and every other episode on my website. My Instagram is the Past Lives Podcast, with an underscore between each word, and on Twitter I am at Simon G. Bown. There's a Past Lives Podcast Facebook group, and if you'd like to join, you'd be very welcome. Okay, so that's all the admin done. Let's move on to this episode. This week I'm talking to Leo Bonomo about his book Summerland and about his career as a medium. Leo trained for 8 years at the Spiritualist Association of Great Britain as a professional evidential medium. Leo is the UK director and certified member of the American Society for Standards in Mediumship. Leo has channeled books available on Amazon called Summerland and A Book of Thoughts with Messages from Spirit. Currently, Leo teaches psychic development and medium workshops. He is the host of a global show on KCOR Radio with expert guests from around the world who discuss spiritual topics. You can find many of his episodes on his YouTube channel. Well, hi, Leo. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. I was reading the book Summerland, and it's so fascinating. And it's a kind of a novel, isn't it? But it was channeled, is that right?
Yes, it was channeled in 1987. And the remarkable thing is it took about 3 years to write. But as far as I was concerned, I was just writing down bits and pieces from Spirit. And it was only at the end where they said, it's completed. And I thought, what's completed? I thought I was just taking various notes. And they said it was a book. And that kind of threw me. And the nice thing is that as it was being channeled, I was physically unconscious. They would wake me up during the night and pester me, a little bit like, you know, that scene in Ghost where he's pestering, singing, I'm Henry VIII, I am. It was that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Until I learned, because it can be a bit thick, get up, write it down, and then I can go to sleep. And so I would begin writing the first few words and physically pass out, and Spirit would move my hand and they'd bring me round at the end of it. And so I would then read it for the first time. And I thought this was just notes and something that might be interesting. But when they said it's finished, I realised then it was a book. And the remarkable thing about that is that even though at one point there was a year between writings, even if it stopped mid-sentence, the next word would carry on from the next word. So the whole thing was a bit of a surprise to me in that way, that there was actually something there. And as I started to collate it, it just all fell into place and it was complete. I think the only thing that weren't there were perhaps some accents, Scottish accents, but the book came complete, you know, and it was a revelation to me. I've read it hundreds of times, of course. And Spirit wrote it, as you mentioned, it's a novel. And the reason they wrote it like that was so that people would enjoy it as a book, but also they would get a lot from it. And it's actually aged children from 10 up to adults. So it's written in a very simple way. You know, when you've got that connection with Spirit, they can explain the most complex things in very simple terms.
And it seems like for you, I think you'd kind of tidied it up in a way, but it was like there are different authors there. It wasn't all one Spirit channeling through.
Absolutely. And it's great that you've spotted that, because someone told me a number of years later, it might have been a decade later, that I was sharing the manuscript with, and they said exactly the same thing. And there are seven different authors in that. And again, remarkably, I hadn't noticed. It seems Summerland itself kind of just grows, which is amazing.
I find it's a great way of putting across the information and the concepts that they talk about, because it could have been just as a book with a whole set of chapters describing, oh, here's this place and here's that place. And But being a story like that and having that character, it's Alex, and how he experiences things from the beginning, and things are explained to him as he goes along. It's almost like they're putting you, the reader, in Alex's position.
Absolutely. I think Spirit's intention was to place ourselves as Alex, and to begin to learn as a newcomer to Summerland or Heaven, whichever name we want to use, because it isn't always straightforward for people. You know, we have quite fixed ideas sometimes of this is what Heaven's like. And there's a character in the book that is sweeping clouds and playing a harp and that kind of thing. And some people do physically feel that that's what Heaven's like. You know, we grow a pair of wings and we play harps. The illustration in the book is that if you feel so mentally strong about something, you will find yourself there. And that's what the other character found. And he couldn't kind of break himself from that. So it's a nice explanation of how some people adapt or don't adapt to passing over, because those that have the greatest problems are those who are highly religious or a very stubborn mind. And so they have fixed ideas of what it should be. And that's how that character found himself.
So basically what it is we find at the beginning is this boy, Alex, he dies and goes to heaven. And then the rest of the book is his experience of learning about Summerland and heaven. But basically, what or and where is Summerland? What is this place?
As far as I've been told, it's about the sixth plane. So in very rough terms, there are seven planes, and so the seventh would be the lower sphere. And we can progress certainly towards the higher spheres, and I'm sure at some point we'll all get there. Between those spheres or planes or worlds, there are millions of dimensions, and this is why we can find ourselves in a world that's perfectly suited to us, with others who think alike, in greatly differing landscapes. You know, some people, for example, who may have been born in a desert, you know, Bedouin, someone from the Bedouin tribe, that's all they experience. So when they pass over, they would feel that they need to be at home, so they would find themselves in that kind of country. You would find people that are used to, you know, forests and that kind of thing. So it feels very natural to us. It's all designed to make us feel comfortable. And so you can move through these planes and also get glimpses of the plane above and maybe a couple down. So wherever we are, we find ourselves perfectly at home. The Summerland is called Summerland because it's eternal summer and blue sky. But for example, if you were very comfortable at 20 degrees and I was very comfortable at 30, we would experience what is perfect for us within the same place. So in a sense, it's incredibly tailored to us. We do create the world that we're going to through our thoughts and actions here.
And it was interesting that there was a kind of a hospital emergency ward where people were coming in. It seemed like they'd just died in an accident. And they didn't tell them, oh, you're dead now. You're in Summerland. You're in heaven. They treated them as though they were still alive.
Yeah. And again, the concept behind that is sometimes it would be a great shock to someone who is newly deceased. And that can happen because the act of passing, whilst we here seem to attach so much importance to it, you know, to that act, it's something that's very, very easily missed. And I usually give the example of someone that's crossing the road and they get hit by a car and the body flies one way and we continue crossing the road. It's as easily missed as that. And so if something would distress us or worry us, then that wouldn't be heaven. So they would approach it in a way which was very, very gentle. And that lady that was involved in an accident in the book, she's treated like that. She finds herself at a hospital because knowing she's been in an accident, that's where she would naturally expect to find herself. So it's all done to calm and to make us feel as normal and as at home as possible. Then people are taken to sometimes rest homes or other places where we get rehabilitated. And then, you know, we're gradually told, well, this is what's happened. And of course we meet our friends and loved ones. So it's a perfect design of keeping us comfortable and very, very gently making us aware.
If there's somebody who has a terminal illness on Earth and they know they're going to die, so after death, do they just find themselves up there completely healed and happy to just carry on and do stuff? Or do they need rest? Do they need kind of like a hospital in Summerland?
Well, they can do for mental issues and various kinds of issues. But it's a good point that you've brought up, because if somebody, for example, is killed in an explosion and literally blown to bits, the second that we enter spirit, we're absolutely complete. So people that have had limbs removed for various reasons, they will be complete when they pass to spirit. Again, depending on their awareness and their expectations, they would be treated accordingly. That's the whole point of spirit communication in a nutshell, is to take away that fear of passing. And we've all passed thousands of times ourselves, is to take that fear away and to show us that it is something normal. You find with people, certainly that are getting into their dotage and getting on, or are having a terminal illness, that their loved ones would begin to visit them, you know, sometimes a few weeks before. So they would begin to see them. And I think the best way to explain it is it's very like a dream. And so you have the waking moments when you're ill, but as you begin to transition from the body, you will have that dream. And what happens is exactly the opposite with birth. That dream becomes more real and our reality becomes more of a dream. And if you speak to people that are terminally ill or just naturally coming to the end of their life, they tend to speak about people that they've seen, loved ones and friends, and they begin to speak to them. And it's a very, very natural process. Again, it's something we've all done thousands and thousands of times. I'm not sure if it's in the book, but my guide said to me one day as I was doing a reading for a lady, and she had a bit of an obsession about passing. And I may be paraphrasing a little here, but he came through very strongly. And he said, "My child, why are you afeard of dying? You are simply entering through a door through which you had previously walked." In other words, we come through that door, that veil, when we're born, and we're simply returning to the same spot. And I thought it was a beautiful way of explaining it to her. The end of that quote was, "You were never afeard of being born." And that's something that we, you know, most people don't think about. We're here, we're alive, we have our life, and death is this terrible, terrible thing, apparently. And we don't give a single thought to, "I wasn't afraid to be born."
Yeah, I heard somebody say, I'm not sure where I heard this, but it's easier to die than to be born. I suppose being born, it can be such a physical sort of traumatic thing. And sometimes when you die, you might just be on your bed with your family around you and you just drift away.
Absolutely. And I think that's a great question. Sometimes there are lots of complications before we're born, and sometimes directly afterwards. And of course, if that's something that we have come here to experience, then those problems may remain with us through life, you know, if there's brain damage or we're paraplegic or something. And so in a sense, that continues. So I think that is a great question. The fear of death really is instigated by religions on the main part. No pun intended, but they literally put the fear of God into you. And passing is very, very natural. Sometimes if there are accidents and that kind of thing, you know, it is still very quick. And one of the things that we also fear, because we have pain in life, you know, pain, being receptive to pain is a useful thing, because it stops the body being damaged. So, you know, if you pick up something hot, there's pain. So it's a very useful thing. And people naturally think that if we're going to die, it's going to be painful. Now, there can be pain leading up to death, but the passing itself is absolutely painless. And you can read many accounts of people just finding that huge peace and sense of bliss, and that really is what passing's about. If you've ever spoken to people that have been badly hurt physically, you will tend to find, if it is something that's serious, you don't feel it, because the body naturally shuts down, you know, it's flooded with its own kind of anesthetic. And so if we are seriously hurt, we tend not to feel it. And if we are going to pass, then there is that natural ascension and loosening of the body, and we just come from that into an ecstatic peace. But that's something that lots of people worry about, you know, that they feel pain and they feel that passing must be worse, the pain must be worse, and quite the opposite is true.
So if we could go back to this, the planes of existence, which plane is Earth on? I kind of assume it's the lowest one.
It is the lowest one. It's very, very dense here, and we have to become accustomed to it. To manipulate this body we have is not an easy thing to do. But as we're progressing as a mammal, as an animal, but also spiritually. If you go back a decade or two, perhaps even longer, it used to take us about a year to learn to walk. We've progressed to the point now where children are walking much earlier. but it's quite a feat, you know, getting the balance of the body. Of course, it's something we don't remember. We walk about, gangly or not, and we kind of take that as natural. I sometimes go into trance, and I'm sometimes lifted completely out of my body for various things. And one time I came back and I found myself dropped in my body, and the physical weight of my arms and legs was incredible. And that experience was given to me. You know, we don't know the weight of our own limbs. And so when we incarnate, we are incarnating into what could crudely be called a meat body, but we have to animate it. And it's not an easy task. You know, just a sense of balance is something that we have to contend with. And so this is a very dense planet. It's a very dense dimension.
Hello, listeners. This is Simon. Now, as some of you know, I have a diploma in clinical hypnotherapy, and I'm certified in past life regression therapy. And in the past few weeks, I've taken many clients through some amazing and healing past life regressions. And I conduct sessions over Zoom, and I've had clients from many countries around the world. Now, when you go through a past life regression, you will feel totally in control and remember everything. And also, I record the whole session and send you an MP3 afterwards. And this gives you space to relax and go with the flow, knowing that you can listen back later and analyse what you experienced if you need to. So if you ever wanted to explore your past lives in a single session, or have an issue you want to work on, you can go to my website at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk and book a free 20-minute consultation. And at the moment, I'm offering a 25% discount to everyone that has signed up to the Patreon campaign. The link is in the show notes. Does it include the whole universe? So I suppose all the planets in the universe are on this plane. So if there's life on other planets, they would equally be incarnating souls and spirits?
Absolutely. Well, if you take our dimension I mean, we can't imagine infinity. It's a lovely word, but we've no idea. You know, if somebody says to you, you know, this planet is 40,000 light years away, you know, we kind of go, okay. I mean, we can't measure it. But if you took, I suppose the best way to explain it is if you took a thin sliver of veneer that was the length and breadth of the universe, and that is the plane that we are on. Well, apart from the seven basic planes, between each of them, there are millions and millions of other planes or planets. So what we see, even though scientists say that 99% of the universe is invisible, it's actually far bigger, than we could ever imagine. And if you then multiply that very thin layer by millions and millions and millions of layers, we still don't have an idea of it. So each of those planes and dimensions would have their own vibration, and worlds would be created within that. So what we see is just a sliver, and there would be other slivers. And it's great that you intimate about other worlds as well, because there is life on other planets. Again, we're seeing one dimension here, but other planets are teeming with life, you know. And if you speak to physical mediums, they will also talk, and for want of a better word, aliens will come through. And they will speak. So there's any amount of life out there in a world the width and breadth of just our sliver. We can't comprehend it at all.
And this is a thing that's come up recently, I think, is people seeing the connection between say, ETs and the afterlife and perhaps reincarnation and souls, where before decades ago, maybe just a decade ago, there'd be people who are interested in UFOs. On the other side, there'd be people interested in afterlife, and there wasn't really any connection between the two. But we're starting to get better insights now.
Oh, hugely. I mean, the whole thing's opened up. There's a very good friend of mine, Kai Mugga, and that's spelled M-E-U-G-G-E. He's German. Kai is on Facebook, and you can contact him. And when he's a physical medium, he's a brilliant physical medium, and ETs will come through. And mediums now are beginning to admit, some of them, that they have alien guides. So it's the barrier between those two particular worlds, as you said, where, you know, there was a definite barrier there. The twain didn't meet, but now it is all intertwined. There's a lovely gentleman called Robin Foy, and they had the skull experiment with his wife and another couple, there was an ET that came through, and his skin was blue, so they called him Blue. And there's video of him there entering the circle. So the two are very connected. And ufologists would often say that people that experienced aliens or UFOs would understand that they were being spoken to or scanned telepathically, but also that a huge feeling of peace come over them. And that's because, most of them are millions of years ahead of us. You know, there's just no comparison. And when people talk about, the aliens, they're here to invade us and that kind of, I mean, they could overrun us. You know, we're like fleas, if that's what they wanted. But they're not like that. There are a few reptilians and those that are antagonistic towards us, but they're held in check by a greater majority of those that are looking after our interests. You know, they're here to stop us destroying ourselves.
Well, talking about Kai Mugga, I've heard of him before, and I'd love to have a sitting with him. And I talked to Stuart Alexander, and I'd hope to have a sitting with him as well. But do you ever have anything physical happen?
I used to when I was young. I was levitated as normal, so literally floated around the room. I found that quite normal. In one sense, my childhood was quite hard because of things that were going on in the family. But on the other hand, I had the most wonderful experiences. And so I would astral project, spirit would manifest, walk around the room. They would show me all kinds of things. And one lovely thing which seems to be fairly rare, I was lying there one night, and it was a cupboard rather than a wardrobe, and the cupboard door opened slightly, and as I peeked round and looked in, I could see a Victorian study, and I kind of got drawn into that area and was watching what was going on, and eventually withdrew, and there were so many things that I took as normal, I kind of take offense a little bit at the word supernormal, because we attach supernormal to it because we don't understand it, but actually it's very normal.
And do you feel that we're kind of closed off from it? I mean, most of us, for a reason. It's a thing where we incarnate in this life to live a life. And perhaps if we knew so much about the afterlife and souls, then that would interfere too much.
I agree 100% with that. I'm never one to try and convert people. Skeptics come into this life to have, as you've intimated, a particular view, a particular experience of life. And so I wouldn't want to take that away from them. But yes, you know, people are born or gain atheist attitudes, or sometimes are driven completely the other way and become ultra religious, but within a very small framework. But I agree, you know, we're here to have various experiences, and we've asked for them. You know, there's an old saying, isn't there, that you can't pick your parents. Well, of course we do, because that is the starting point of life. The parents' family and the social surroundings are something that would feed us, that would give us experiences to build our life on. And so we do pick our parents, and we pick, you know, the whole situation. And sometimes I'm asked, you know, well, you know, if I had a choice, then I would have picked rich and comfort and no illness and that kind of thing. But I found that some of the most advanced souls are those that are born in huge hardship. From a human point of view, why would we want to be born into maybe South Africa, where there are wars and you know, famine and terrible, terrible hardship? As a human, we'd think, why would we want that? You know, perhaps we'll be born in California, in Hollywood or somewhere, have a great life. From a physical point of view, that offers something. But from a spiritual point of view, you can learn an awful lot more by being born in a war-torn society and those hardships. You know, I've found that some of the most spiritual souls I've ever met have been quadriplegics or suffered, you know, in some way very greatly. And often those souls incarnate because the group of people that they're going to meet, it's a karmic reward, if you like. So if you take the example of someone being born with terrible health conditions and they need looking after all their lives, they are in contact with people who have the choice of doing something good. But as we know, sometimes in homes and that kind of surroundings, people are not treated well at all. So the person that's incarnated is there to give others a chance to do the right thing. So lots of these things are more complex than they seem at first glance. And you know, if they've been born to give that person a chance to do the right thing and find humanity within themselves, then that's a good thing. But we always have free will, and if that's expressed as in anger and brutality within those kind of conditions, then you know, you are at their mercy. But spiritual souls would take that on.
It's interesting, in the book there's a point in Summerland where it's that I think Alex is being taught something, and he's told it's no good living the life of a saint while you're thinking bad things. You got to have it in your heart to be doing the good things, not just trying to do it so you look good.
Yes, and again, you know, it was something that I found wonderful when I first read that back, because you know, it's the difference between what's inside and what you show. And there's a lovely old English phrase, which is all fur coat and no drawers. In other words, it's all just for show. And if we live our life just for show, then we're missing an awful lot of the experiences that we could have. You know, if we're down to earth and we try and help people, or, you know, we say we can't do that, we have to be real. as they say. And if you're just doing things for show, it's a very hollow existence. And that's really what was being explained at that part of the book.
Now, there's a great photo in the book when you're a child in the garden, and there's a kind of astral figure in the background, your grandfather, and he's transparent. Yeah. Can you tell us about that picture?
Well, the original picture is probably an inch and a half by an inch and a quarter. And when I first saw that picture, there was just myself and my sister in it. And it was taken in our first house in Forest Gate, East London. And I lost the picture for some time. And I then found it again, and I was staring at it. And I couldn't believe my eyes, because I could see that shadow. And I didn't realise at first it was my grandfather. But as that image has become clearer within the picture, it's very obviously him. Now, the interesting thing is, I was born in 1957 and my grandfather passed in 1933. And that's why in the book I've got a picture of his tomb. And in Italy and generally on the continent, and we're tending to start it now, they have a picture of the deceased. So you can see that it's him. But I was about six, maybe seven in that picture. And there's a little tree to my right. And when we left Forest Gate, that tree was about 30 foot tall. But we hadn't noticed originally, but there are lots of figures in that as well. For a long time I couldn't see it, but to my grandfather's left, there's an outline of a woman. And I went through a phase where I could see it, and then I went through a phase where I couldn't see it again, but now it's plain. So it kind of plays with the clairvoyance a little bit. And I had a friend over, Maggie Hahn. She's the granddaughter of Helen Duncan. And she was at my house one day, and I was showing her the picture, and she started to describe the woman. So I said to her, hold on, and I went and got some old family photographs and laid them all out. And she said, that's the lady, and that's my grandmother. So to his left is my grandmother. But within that picture now, I took a copy, and I've got a large copy in the house. There are about 18 figures in it now, including rabbits and various animals. It's something that's growing. But it's a lovely picture.
And I suppose at that age, you were experiencing some mediumship talent, some psychic talent?
My first experience was at the age of two. And we'd been coming back from visiting family. Not too far from Forest Gate is a place called Manor Park. And Manor Park Cemetery, we were going past that. It was still light. It was about 7:30 at night. It was summer. And I felt a presence behind me. So I turned and I saw a mist horizontal on the pavement. And through the mist horizontally came a gentleman. And then he upended and stood upright. I didn't find anything strange about that at all. But my dad realised I was looking at something, so he asked me, and I said, there's a funny man behind us. Well, we all turned back, and none of us could see anything, and we've sort of eyes front again, and I've looked over my shoulder again, and there he was. And this happened a few times, and the only thing that I found odd was he was dressed in Victorian clothing. The fact that he'd risen out the pavement didn't faze me at all. It was just the clothing was a bit weird. So it was, I suppose in one sense I could say that was my awakening to spirit, but children are very close to spirit. As a rough guide up to about five or six, we're much more connected to spirit than earth. And from about six-ish, we tend to get grounded because we need to be here. And so a lot of people lose that connection with spirit at that point. And if it's meant to come back, then it tends to. But for me, it was more of a reminding than an awakening. So I didn't find any of it strange at all.
Do you ever notice that pets pay attention to spirit? Because sometimes I see a cat just staring at something and it seems like there's nothing there.
Absolutely. You know, it's a strange thing. They have retained that sensitivity. And due to the Industrial Revolution and us, you know, working different hours and being more intensified on life, as it were, we've lost that natural ability. So if we go before that, you know, we would naturally tend to know which herbs were good for us, which were poisonous, what we could use. We had that very, very strong sixth sense. And we needed that. You know, when there were wild animals in this country, we needed to be careful. So we had those senses. And modern living has taken a lot of that out. But what's happened now is that's tending to come back. So we are being born more and more with those senses intact and retaining them. I was visiting my ex-mother-in-law some years ago, and as I knocked on the door, she said, come here, have a look. And we went upstairs, and my youngest daughter, Daniela, was looking and laughing. She was looking at the corner of the room, and she was wetting herself laughing. And my ex-mother-in-law said she's been like that for over half an hour now. And spirit were entertaining her, you know. So it is something that is quite natural. Children tend to see them. I think it depends partly on the era that you were born, but also the attitude. You know, if you're not open to this, but there's that common saying, isn't there, of children having imaginary friends. A lot of the time they are not imaginary. You know, so it's a natural gift we have. But as I say, we get to a point when we get grounded and we lose that contact for a while.
And you wrote this book sort of in trance. You say that you would sort of wake up and it would just be written in front of you.
Yeah, well, what would happen was they would pester me with words, and I would wake up in what's called the witching hour, usually between 1 and 4, but normally between 1 and 3. And I would wake up with these words going round and round and round in my head. So having been used to that, I would just find some scrap paper and pick up a pen, and I would be conscious of writing the first 3 or 4 words. But after that, I would physically be unconscious, and spirit would take my hand. So it's called automatic writing, and they physically wrote it. And unfortunately, during a divorce, I lost the original papers. But in the original papers, it was written on the backs of envelopes. It was written on all kinds of scraps. But there were differences in the writing. And that goes back to that point you made, that there are different people, you know, that have taken part in that book.
So do you mean you could see it was different handwriting, that you could tell it was different people who were controlling the pen?
I had noticed that the writing was different at times. You know, even then I hadn't sort of put 2 and 2 together that it would be different people. I just put it to having less control at some times than others. So I hadn't thought about it too deeply. But it was only when it was first mentioned years ago that I kind of reread Summerland. And I could see where there were some changes, but not all of them are obvious to me.
Going into that condition, though, if you're getting up and you know that you're going to be doing this automatic writing and that you would in some way be unconscious while some spirit entity had control of your body, I mean, for me, that sounds really creepy, and you think, well, but I don't want to give up control.
Well, again, I think, you know, if you grow up with it and you grow up going into trance and having physical things happen, there is a lot of trust that's involved with the guide and the team that are taking control of the situation and making sure, you know, that you are safe, that there is nothing that's going to interfere or enter or attach itself. So in a sense, I suppose it's a bit like an operating theatre, you know, it's a very clean environment. So there was no question of fear or doubt in my mind. I just knew that I had to start writing and I would be conscious of the first few words. But it's a very, very protected environment.
And that's one of the things they talk about in the book, is that the lady is talking to Alex about lower, I don't know if it's lower planes or lower dimensions, and there are spirits there that are really stuck in a very kind of dark mindset, and that sometimes people or other higher spirits, so to speak, will go down and try and help them out. So I was just wondering if you ever had a fear that one of those lower level spirits might try and take control.
It wasn't something that occurred to me, because I had some experiences which were dark, but it was in a protected environment, and what spirit were doing were they were allowing these experiences to build up so that I would be conscious myself of something not being right and being given the chance to sense it and then react. And so whilst from their point of view it's a very controlled experiment, I would find myself being affected in particular ways and then realizing something wasn't wrong and something wasn't right. And it was brought to my attention in my dad's house, in his room, there was an older gentleman who I remember vividly. And I was having all these experiences, and he started to leave my dad's room and kind of approach me. And he started to overshadow me, which is a subtle change where they don't take over, but they influence you and can influence you quite strongly. And so I kind of got used to that. And being curious that what I was experiencing was real, I took a screwdriver one day, and while he was inhabiting me, I scratched the top of the cupboard above my head, so just to get an idea of my height, because I knew something extraordinary was happening. And the next morning when I measured it, it was 6'1". Now, I've only ever been 5'8" at my greatest height, so there was something very physical happening there, so that was of interest to me. But as the months bore on, his arms started to sort of distort and screw up, and I began to think there's something not quite right here, and I wondered how I was going to find out. And we're kind of back to animals and intuition, and we had a cat, and I thought, right, well, cats can see things. Excuse me. I'll wait till he takes over again, and then I'll go find the cat. And this happened, and what had happened was he took over. I unlocked my bedroom door, and I went out onto the landing, and the cat took one look at me, its back arched, and we used to have wood chip wallpaper, and it literally ran vertically up the wall and across the ceiling. It was so frightened. So I realized at that point there was my instinct was right. There was something very wrong. So I went back into my room, locked the door, and my guide showed me how to deal with it. So again, it's very anesthetized environment, completely under their control, but allowing me to sense and experience sometimes how spirit can appear to attach very normally and very kind and very lovely, but that can change. And so it was a great experience. It's perhaps not something everyone would want to go through, but it taught me an awful lot. And you know, there are some organizations and mediums that just don't believe there's any kind of negative energy. And to me, that's incredible, because spirit, you know, the essence of spirit is the body we had. And we know from looking at this world that, you know, there are incredibly savage people. The notion that they, because while we're here, we're creating a world, as I explained earlier, that we will inhabit. And for a notion of people like that to suddenly find themselves in paradise, or Summerland, just doesn't sit right. And the way the example that was given to me was that if you are a torturer and child murderer, when you pass, you will find yourself in a similar place. There's a spiritual law, like attracts like. So you would find yourself in that place. And if we equate that to the earth, you would find yourself in a place with another 8 billion souls that are murderers and torturers. And that's really where our idea of hell comes from, of finding ourselves in those places. So when Alex is shown, because there is a connection between him and a character, which he doesn't realize at that point, that there are rescue teams, if you like, that will go down to the lower levels. And as soon as they see a spark of humanity or regret, those people are taken up and they're lifted up vibrationally and helped. And that is something that happens. So Alex was shown that, and in the end, he connects with a character that he's met earlier in the book, and he's quite shocked to see what the gentleman has become because of that highly negative situation.
It's interesting, because I've interviewed people on this podcast who've had distressing near-death experiences. And they've gone to a place which sounds very much kind of like that, a place where there's just seems like there's so many lost souls who are just nasty people.
Yeah, yeah. And again, you know, that without judging any of those people, if they've had those experiences, that there is a definite reason why they would be drawn there. I had an interesting dialogue with a skeptic. And he wrote to me on my blog many years ago, and he was espousing that he'd had a near-death experience, and that he'd been there, there was nothingness, it was dark, and that was it. And so I wrote back to him and said, I think you're missing the point, because you were aware of nothingness, you were aware of darkness. You know, if as a skeptic claims there is nothing there, you wouldn't be aware of that kind of environment. You know, according to them, there is nothing, so we are nothing. And not surprisingly, I didn't get an answer.
I'm going to ask you a big question now. It's probably a difficult one. They speak often of God in that book, Summerland. So yeah. How would you define the God that they speak of? Because I got the impression it wasn't the Christian God or any other of the religion's God.
Absolutely. Well, the word God was given, and that aspect was given to the book so that it, people would have some concept in their mind of a creator. The divine creator is a living positive energy that learns from everything that we do, Its knowledge, of course, is far greater than ours, but it's a creator. But it's very difficult to put into words what it is. That there are no human words or language that could describe it. I suppose, in a sense, the easiest way to say that it's more of a feeling. But the divine creator had to be given a name. And I think Spirit just chose the word God because we would all relate to a God, whether we were religious or not. You know, we would have that idea in our mind of, oh, that's God. The interesting thing is I've got a book written by a surgeon, and it's called A Thousand Near-Death Experiences. And again, it goes back to that feeling of comfort that I was going to say we, there's obviously someone with me, that we explained, and that is that you have to feel comfortable. So if you were born a Buddhist, then you're very likely at some point in your passing to see Buddha. If you're Indian or Jewish or whatever religion you will follow, you tend to see the associated God. And so Christians tend to see a Jesus or a Jesus figure. And again, that's of comfort, that if you are religiously inclined in that way, then you would see something or someone that would give you that comfort. Jesus does exist. Lots of mediums would agree that he was the greatest medium and healer on earth, really. So he is a real character in heaven, or well, it's not heaven, it's way above that, really, but you know, at the top. So the book has that aspect because of that it's a word. Whatever connotations we give to it, it's a word we recognize and we have associations with.
And if somebody wanted to have a sitting with you, do you do it over Zoom?
I can do it over Zoom. I do it over Skype, FaceTime, do Zoom. There are other methods. I tend to do most of them by phone or Skype nowadays, because obviously we're just coming out of this. And people sometimes ask, you know, if I'm reading for someone in Australia, how does that work? Does it diminish the connection? And it doesn't, for the simple reason, again, that there is no time or space in spirit. So if I was given a reading to someone in Australia, for example, there are two scenarios with the contact. One is that the communicator is with me, giving me the information to pass down the phone. Sometimes the communicator is with them, giving me the information, because that distance and time and space doesn't affect it at all. Phone, yeah, Skype, any means, really.
How would somebody find you? What's your website address?
The website address is www.leo-bonomo.com. I can also be found on Facebook and various places, but the website would be the main.
Do you have any advice for people who see mediums where perhaps there are things you should look out for, like alarm bells that go off and you think, hang on, this medium's not so talented as they think they are?
Yeah, I've been teaching on and off for over 25 years now, and the messages have to be evidential. You have to recognize what's being given to you in the first instance. If it's not always recognizable, then it should be something that you can research either through your own family. Myself as a medium, I don't ask questions. I don't want any information at all. because to me that clouds the issue. It can cloud the information that's given. So mediums shouldn't ask questions. If they're fishing for questions, or you're getting very vague information, you know, there are some favorite hates of mine, pet hates, and one of them is a medium doing a demonstration in a hall and saying, oh, I've got someone, the name's John, surname Smith, I'm over there somewhere. There is no need for that. No need for that. If the communicator is with you, what I insist on with the communicator is show me who you're with. And that can be quite funny. Sometimes I just see lights or they're standing behind a person. Sometimes if they've got a sense of humour, they're going, it's this one here, and they're pointing at them. But you should always know where you are. It's very rare in a hall, I don't know who I'm with. But if I don't know, I'm within two or three people. It's not like I'm over on this side, you know, of 100-seated people. The other pet hate of mine is a medium asking a question in a sort, it's a sort of odd way. You know, they say, why am I seeing this green door? There is no reason to ask. Ask the communicator in spirit. They have the answers. They have shown you a green door. They know what they mean by it. But mediums do ask questions, and it's something that, you know, we can get round. I put it down to bad training. You know, it's much more effective to say, you know, I've got a lady here and describe her age and how she passed, how she's connected to the family. And, you know, for her to say something quite profound, you know, to me, that's evidential. Stuff you sometimes would have to research. There's a myth that you know everybody that comes through, another pet hate of mine is for a medium to go to, you know, a 70-year-old woman in the crowd and saying, I've got your mum here. You know, I mean, what are the chances? those kind of things I don't like. But you can get very good information. If you insist on getting good information from your guides, the guide's job is to oversee the proceedings on the spirit side. So they will instruct the communicator how to communicate with the medium. Now, I know that sounds strange, but in our heads, we all have our own kind of personal vocabulary. You know, this implies that, and we can join the dots and from a couple of simple images, you know, a red door, for example, would mean something to us, or a dandelion would have a special connection. And so what the guide does is instruct the communicator, if you want to show this, then show a dandelion. They learn the code to communicate with me. And it makes things so much more simple, because as they show me a dandelion, for example, it would mean a particular thing, and all I need to do is to repeat what it means. It can get slightly more complicated because there are all kinds of nuances that go along with that. But the guide and spirit communicators, everything should be simple. Because it needn't be complicated. And if you speak to mediums that say, well, you know, it's very complicated and I've trained for 30 years and, it needn't be like that at all. It should be simple.
Are there any times where you've had information from a communicator and thought, you know, it's probably best not to pass that on? I don't know. Maybe yeah. They're saying, well, you know, this person's going to be very ill soon or something.
Yeah, I mean, with good mediumship, you always want to leave the recipient feeling good. So there are times when, you know, someone in spirit will say, they're really not well. You know, they're going to go through quite a severe illness, and you know, that may be that, and you wouldn't tell people that. You know, so there are all kinds of things that years ago when you were trained as a medium, it was at least 5 years before you got anywhere near a platform. And part of the tutor's job was not only to train you, but to weed out the people with no common sense. And we seem to have lost that nowadays. All kinds of people are getting trained that, quite honestly, shouldn't be anywhere near a platform. They shouldn't be giving messages. They just blurt these things out. So you need a sense of common sense, and the mind should be filtering things that are coming through. You know, many people in life swear like a trooper, and it's fair enough to say, well, you know, this communicator, there's a lot of ripe language. But that doesn't mean that we would swear or repeat those words. We would get a hint of it and then say, you know, language is very ripe with this person. So there are things that we filter out that we have to, you know, and that can be on any level. I did a reading for somebody online, and I tend never to remember readings or any part of them unless there's something for me to learn personally, and I learn something every day, or I learn something that I can pass on to students. And this guy had he'd booked a 20-minute reading, and he was just asking basic questions, and you know, it didn't really mean much to me. And then about 10 or 11 minutes in, he said to me, "I think my wife's having an affair." And that was the whole purpose of what he wanted to know. And my guide materialized in front of me and did that finger motion across the throat. In other words, cut the conversation. So I said to the guy, "I'm losing the connection and that, really sorry." And he put the phone down, and I said to my guide, "What is going on?" And he said, the gentleman wants something to say that his wife is committing adultery. He's going to kill her.
He's looking for an excuse.
He's just looking for an excuse. And I thought, thank God that is not on my conscience. But the way that he phoned, there's no way of tracing the call. So there wasn't anything I could do, but I knew that he would be phoning lots of mediums, and he just wanted a consensus that yes, something's going on. And it was shocking to me, you know, but thank God my guide stepped in, and that isn't on my conscience. But so there are times when we can't say, for all kinds of reasons. We spirit are not allowed to take away free will. So if something's coming up and it's very close and you are going to make a decision, for example, spirit won't give information to say, look, you shouldn't do that because that is going to go badly wrong, because you need that experience. It's part of the reason that you've been born, to have that experience of it going wrong and to correct it. But if it was something was maybe 6 months away and they said, you know, this is going to happen, you know, you need to change jobs, and they go yes, and say, right, well, 6 months ahead, something's coming up, you've got a choice, and think about it, but we feel that this may be an option. So it just gives them something to think about. It doesn't take that away. We can't take away free will and guide people into an action that perhaps, if we've got it wrong, that, you know, it could cause all kinds of problems. So, yeah, we have to have discernment.
So the sitter has to have common sense as well. They shouldn't just believe everything they hear and take massive life-changing decisions on it.
Absolutely. And I say to recipients, if 80 to 90% of what I've given is correct, then the predictions tend to be correct. And, you know, this is something that, again, mediums and some institutions don't seem to want to tackle. It's that everything is known in spirit. Again, there is no time. So everything is known, whether the communicator is told and whether the communicator is allowed to tell me are two completely different things. So again, discernment is needed. But if they are allowed to tell me, then I would be very careful with the phrasing. Again, you know, we have to leave it so that a person makes up their own mind. Because, if a medium makes a mistake, it would affect that person. We have no idea. It could affect that family for generations. And when we pass over, they'll say, look what you did. You gave this information. You knew it wasn't right, or you felt bad about it, but you gave it anyway, and this is the result. And when we pass over, we go through life reviews. So we know what we've done, good and bad, and we see we see what comes from that. So, for example, if we've hurt someone, not only do we relive that and say, yeah, we hurt them, we did this or we said that, we physically feel the pain that they have gone through, that we have put them through. So it's not like watching a film or having a reminder. There is huge emotion there. And in the same way, it's worse for a medium, because we should have that sense of the information that we're giving. And if we've said something that's destructive, not only do we feel intimately what that person's gone through, but that may have affected their family for generations. And so we relive all those ripples of that problem that we've caused. And it should be that way, but not many mediums are made aware of that. You know, it's a serious thing.
Well, it's been great talking to you. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. We went a bit long there, and it's such a great conversation. Well, the book Summerland is on Amazon, isn't it? It's on Kindle, and people can get paperback as well.
They can get the paperback at the moment. It's still being advertised there, but we're trying to get a reprint. The original printer, bless him, passed away in a fire, and we had problems getting plates back and things, but it's currently being reprinted. So Kindle might be the best option, but yes, there's a paperback version.
Right. Fantastic. Thanks again for coming on the podcast. It's been great talking to you.
It's been my privilege, Simon. Thank you so much.
And that was an interview with Leo Bonomo about his book Summerland and about his career as a medium. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/pastlivespodcast or click on the button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. There are two tiers, and if you join the $2 a month tier, you get a bonus episode every month. If you join the $5 a month tier, you can have access to a bonus episode every week, the back catalogue of over 100 bonus episodes, and the extended versions of the free one-hour episodes. And also, if you're a patron, you'll get a 25% discount when you book a past life regression session with me. And if you enjoy the podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.